Matt Bubala Show on 720 WGN. One of the topics we talked about leading up to this election several times, many times, was the immigration issue that had been brought forth really heavily by the Trump campaign, and a lot of talk about walls and kicking bad hombres out and things like that. So now there will be a Trump presidency. So what will happen? The gentleman we talked to many times over the course of the campaign was Chris Chmielewski. He's the director of content and activism for Numbers USA. That's a grassroots type of organization that deals with immigration issues, not generally in the same way that President-elect Trump did, but certainly he brought the issue to the forefront. Chris jumps on the phone with us again now. Hey, Chris, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
I don't want to put you on the spot here because a lot of the country's upset and a lot of the country's really happy, but as far as Numbers USA is concerned, is this administration going to be good news? I imagine at least it's an issue with them, and certainly not that they're more wanting to keep things under control than a Clinton administration, I guess. Maybe that's unfair for me to say about the Clinton administration, but Clinton administration was more pro. I'm not going to say they were open borders because I think that was a ridiculous accusation, but they were more open to more people coming in versus Trump, who wants people out. So where does Numbers USA fall in this, or are you just staying out of it altogether?
well, we don't pick sides, but we do rate the candidates on their issues when they're leading up. We don't have to discuss that now because we have an election with a winner.
Right.
So what we're most pleased about, certainly there was a lot of focus on Trump's position dealing with deportations, the handling of refugees, and the wall that he called for along the southern border. We come at immigration from, we certainly look at the enforcement aspect of it, but we really look at, we were founded on the basis of legal immigration numbers and do the total number of people that we admit into our country every single year legally serve in the national interest. We've been bringing in about 1 million people per year. We think that puts a lot of pressure on American workers, on their jobs, on their wages. We're not necessarily saying these folks come in and take jobs from Americans, but they certainly add extra unnecessary workplace competition. We're not saying reduce immigration to zero. We push for cutting it in half down to about 500,000 from its current levels of 1 million, which is about the rate that it was at between the end of World War II and roughly 1990. And Trump has certainly made statements along the way that is on that same sort of path of thinking. Mm-hmm. He said that we need to reduce immigration, reduce the competition in the workforce until Americans can get back to work. We need to make sure that we have a fair policy so that workers aren't coming in and foreign workers aren't coming in and taking jobs that Americans could be also getting themselves. And if you look at where this election was decided, assuming that Michigan ends up going into Trump's column, you know, you can take Florida out of the equation now. Trump would have won without Florida, assuming he wins with Michigan. So this election really came down to the Rust Belt, came down to Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And that's the manufacturing, the old industrial Rust Belt. And these are the folks that have been most impacted, that they've seen their wages go down and they've seen the loss of new jobs. Because there are lots of factors, but we believe that immigration has been one of the factors that has contributed to it.
Well, it's interesting because that's not what I heard him saying at all when it comes to factory jobs. It's that the factory jobs left the country, so immigrants didn't come take those jobs. It's that we brought them to the possible immigrants in other countries. How did immigrants affect manufacturing?
When somebody comes into the country, especially now you have some employers that hire folks that come to the country illegally, and then they're obviously not, they don't have to pay them a minimum wage. They don't have to cover them in terms of, they don't have to pay for their payroll, their side of the payroll taxes. So they don't have to pay that portion. So it's much, much cheaper for them to hire illegal workers. Not saying that most, not saying that most employers do that, but there are some employers that do that. So that's one aspect of it. But the second thing is that a lot of times when new immigrants come to the country legally, now we see through government data, they tend to be less educated than U.S. workers. And they're coming from countries that have a much lower standard of living in many cases, where wages aren't as high as they are in the United States. So they're willing to work where a U.S. factory worker may demand $20 an hour because that's what they need for a living wage. A new foreign worker that comes to the country legally may only need $10-$12 an hour in order to live the kind of lifestyle that they're used to living. So it's a way that business owners can reduce wages by hiring workers that don't demand as high of a pay in order to survive.
One aspect of this that I think you brought up in one of our previous interviews, I know you said you're not saying that immigrants come here and necessarily steal jobs away from Americans, but there is an aspect of we assume, and I've talked about this before on my side, that I hear a lot about sometimes we need these immigrants to do jobs that Americans aren't necessarily doing, or we'd have trouble filling, migrant farmers, different things like that, maybe lower end. When I was a kid, everybody worked at McDonald's once. Now when I go to McDonald's, I never see a teenager. I see middle age or young to middle age Hispanic women and men generally working there. That's just the McDonald's I go to. So I think there's been a shift. But I want to say that you also brought up that there's a lot of legal immigrants who come over who take skilled jobs and better jobs, and they can pay them less. Is that an issue as well?
It is, and specifically with some of the guest worker programs, the H-1B program. So you've seen that with many of the examples that have been reported on by the media over the last couple of years. Disney World was the one that gained the most attention. Southern California Edison, the electric company down in Southern California, Toys R Us. So what these companies have done is they've eliminated tech positions, and they've hired foreign tech workers to fill those positions using the H-1B visa program.
So they're still here. It's not like shipping out the customer service overseas. These are still jobs here, but they lay everybody off, form a new division or whatever, and then hire foreign workers that they can pay a lesser rate.
Exactly. And it's not outsourcing. It is an insourcing, in effect. What they're doing is they have jobs that they're either creating or they're moving Americans out of and then filling them with new foreign workers that are coming to the country.
And if I remember, the key to that is not only just that they're doing that, bad enough as it is, but if they bring them in on this program, those workers are really stuck in that job, aren't they?
They are. What happens with the H-1B visa is it's actually that work visa is applied for by the employer applies for it. It's not the employee applies for it. So what happens is, an employee tries to find a company that he wants to work for, he or she wants to work for, who's not in the country right now. They find an employer. They apply for the job. The employer hires that person and applies for an H-1B visa on their behalf. So the employer actually pays for the cost of the visa so they can hire that worker. But what happens is there are some requirements within the H-1B program that the employer is required to meet. The one that's talked about the most is the prevailing wage requirement. So they're required to pay the worker a prevailing wage. But in many cases, the foreign worker who's coming in doesn't have as much experience as the American worker that used to fill that job. So they can pay that person much less just based off of their experience. And as we know, across the country, there's lots of different there's many different pay scales. So, for instance, a computer programmer in Des Moines, Iowa is not going to make the same that a computer programmer makes in Silicon Valley simply because of the cost of living expenses between those two communities. But the prevailing wage is an average of wages across the entire country. So it does allow a company in Silicon Valley, for example, to hire an entry-level computer programmer at a much, much lower salary because they pay them the average salary across the country, they could pay them a prevailing wage that's based on national averages. They're not paying them the salary, the prevailing wage for Silicon Valley alone. So they can pay a worker much, much less. So the cost of the visa for the employer is just, that's a very small expense compared to the total amount of money that they could save. Then it's a 3-year visa that can be renewed once, so they can be here for 6 years. And that employee is tied to that company for the years that they have the H-1B visa. So it prevents that worker from applying for another job with another company for a higher pay rate. So it creates a less mobile workforce, more dependent workforce, which is something that the employer wants.
Well, and maybe it's not the proper term, but it sounds slightly like a bit of indentured servitude, right? I mean, they're stuck there.
It is. I mean, you can say it's a form of indentured servitude. You automatically think of, okay, indentured servitude is usually associated with lower wage jobs. But it absolutely is. For the tech industry, it's an indentured servitude.
All right. We're speaking with Chris Chmielewski. He is the director of content and activism for Numbers USA. That's part of the immigration issue. Let's talk about some of the more hot button topics: refugees, deportations, and the wall. We'll talk about that next. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Matt Bubala Show on 720 WGN. Coming out of this election, of course, immigration was such a huge issue, and Chris Chmielewski has been our expert throughout the process as we got to the day where Donald Trump was actually elected president of the United States. He's the director of content and activism for Numbers USA, and he's been kind enough to spend a lot of time on the phone with us over these last 10 months or so describing the different issues with immigration, a lot of which we never heard a peep about during the election and the campaigning, because all we heard about was the wall and bad hombres. So let's talk about some of the different hot button issues. One was Trump said that Hillary just wants to throw open the borders and let everybody across. I don't think that was quite her plan, but one thing that she did want to do was allow a certain amount of Syrian refugees and refugees from war-torn countries and people that we felt we could trust to come into the country. Now, they would debate. The Trump side would say we weren't going to be able to trust these people. They weren't going to check them hard enough. And, of course, Hillary's side said, yes, of course we will. They'll all be great people. Don't worry about it. Where do we stand now, or at least where do you think we'll stand come January 20th, as far as it is with issues around the world and allowing refugees to come to our country?
So the Refugee Act of 1980 gave pretty much full discretion over the refugee resettlement program to the executive branch. So the only thing that Congress does is provides funding for it, and for the most part, Congress has funded it at whatever level the president has requested it to be funded at. So while it's been an issue, it's been definitely more of a back burner issue because the program's essentially been on autopilot since then. We've let in anywhere between 50,000 to 70,000 refugees per year, resettled 50 to 70,000 refugees per year, depending on what the world situation happens to be like in any given year. So this issue came to the forefront because of the Syrian civil war that continues to go on and the mass exodus that we've seen from Syria. And it comes down to, okay, how many of these folks do we want to let in? And what it did was it brought attention to the fact that, you know what, Congress, our elected officials really haven't checked on how this program has been operating since 1980. Essentially, and the government doesn't resettle refugees. For the most part, the government is involved in the vetting and the picking out selection process along with the United Nations. But for the most part, the government subcontracts this out to non-governmental organizations. And they just provide them with the money to help resettle folks into the United States is the way that it works. So there's lots of examples of fraud and corruption within the program because it's gone unchecked for over 30 years by Congress, and it just kind of runs on autopilot, and it's not a program that the government even runs. They subcontract it out to non-government agencies. So
okay, so there's a lot of issues there. Let's talk about the refugees themselves. As
sure,
far as
absolutely.
Our overall immigration policy and our standing in the world, because I think it'd be easy to say, you know, we've got enough going on here. We don't need to take people in. I imagine it's not just about us doing good for others, but also about our standing in the world and our allies and different things like that. So where do you stand on refugees?
Or what is Numbers USA stand? Because it brings in all sorts of foreign policy issues. So not only has President Obama said that or announced that he had wanted to increase the flow of specifically Syrian refugees and help in the resettlement of Syrian refugees, but he wants to drastically expand it. Secretary Clinton ran on expanding it even more than that, five times. the amount of refugees. Trump has announced that he will not allow in any refugees from terrorist sponsoring countries. And that position comes from, and that's a position that we somewhat share with him. And it's based on comments that have made by specifically James Comey and Jay Johnson, who have said that, yes, we can vote vet these folks. And Secretary Johnson, the Secretary of Department of Homeland Security, has said that he's confident about the folks that we're settling here. But both of them have admitted that not only can we not fully vet refugees from Syria, because Syria just doesn't have the infrastructure that we can tap into to do full criminal background checks and verify that these people are who they say they are.
Mm-hmm.
But another reason, because Secretary Jay Johnson has said that there are examples of ISIS and other terrorist groups trying to infiltrate the refugee flow. So these are both concerns for, not only the refugee program as a whole, but we've seen these concerns. The current administration says we're being very careful. Trump has said we don't want to do it. But at the same time, as you pointed out, we're a country that does care about the folks that are being displaced because of the Syrian civil war, and we want to help them. A lot of them, and you've seen some of this through some of the interviews that we've seen on television, 60 Minutes did a huge piece about this a few months ago. The folks that are leaving, they actually want to go back to Syria after the war. They don't want to leave their homes forever and ever and ever. They someday hope that they can return to their homes. So we think the best thing to do is try to create safe zones close to their region where they can get food, water, shelter, clothing, and security, so their lives are no longer at risk or put in danger. Help them there, and then when the war is over, hopefully it ends at some point, and it's safe for them to return back home, they can go back home. When they come to the United States, that's a permanent resettlement.
Mm-hmm.
They are, in all likelihood, never, ever going to return back to their homes. There are some folks that their homes have been destroyed. It'll never, ever, ever be... They'll never have a chance of going home. Those we have to look at those. Those are special humanitarian situations that we need to look at. But for the most part, we think it's better. Let's help these folks closer to their home. Center for Immigration Studies came out with a study about 6 months to a year ago that found that using the United Nations figures, we could help 12 Syrian refugees in a safe zone closer to their homes than at the same rate for helping one Syrian refugee resettle to the United States. So truly, if we want to help more people, the best way to do it is to try to create these safe zones where, again, we can provide them with safety, security, food, shelter, water, and whatever, and they can eventually return to their homes when the war is over.
And that is the Donald Trump plan that he talked about safe zones quite a bit. I don't know how much you've looked into that. I certainly haven't at all. But these are what sounds like tent cities and things like that. I feel like I'm imagining the other side is saying that's not a real solution. That's a temporary solution that cannot last years and years until they can safely go back. Is that the argument from the other side? And do you think are there studies or organizations that say no, this can feasibly done and this be good for people?
It is, as you described. I mean, those are certainly good arguments from the other side, and not just that, but a lot of these refugee camps are controlled by the terrorist groups themselves. So they've infiltrated the refugee camps. So we've seen reports that it's not safe for example, Christians from Syria who are refugees to go to these camps because if they're led by, if they're led by terrorist groups, their lives could be put at risk. But that's where the United States can take more of a leadership role and try to create these safe zones that are safe for anybody, regardless of what their religious background is, and provide them with a little bit more infrastructure, not just have them in tents where conditions are, substandard. Create a good situation for them. Now, if the war goes on longer and longer and longer and longer, then we'll probably have to reevaluate the situation down the road and figure out what can we do with these folks to help them out more. We don't know how long the war is going to go. But again, resettling them in the United States, in most cases, that is a permanent move. When we resettle them here, and think, if you're from a war-torn country halfway across the globe, you know, as much as they want to get out of the situation that they may currently be in, how would you feel if you're being resettled all the way across on the other side of the world?
Yeah.
Being put into a country where you don't know the language, you don't have any family there, you don't know anything about your surroundings.
Well, Chris, yes, there's maybe that, or there's people that are going, "Oh my God, I hit the jackpot! Look at where we are now."
Exactly.
You know, I mean, there's both sides of that.
All right,
we're running out of time, so real quick, I want to hit a couple other things quickly.
Sure.
Deportations and enforcement. President-elect Trump started out very hard on that during the primary process. He eased up a little bit on it, saying, you know, we'll figure everything else out before we decide about mass deportations. Where do you think things are going to stand with that, and what would you recommend?
Well, what I think he's going to do, and while I'm not exactly sure what he's going to do, but I do know what he said based on his 100 days speech that he gave in Pennsylvania and the immigration speech that he gave towards the end of August. What we would hope he would do is begin by focusing on criminal aliens, focus on people who are in the country illegally, who have created crimes or who have committed crimes, been convicted of those crimes, and for one reason or another, they haven't been removed by our government, or they have not been able to remove them because their home countries would not take them back. There's a big enough group of criminal aliens in the United States that could be removed, that alone could take a year or two.
Okay.
Just to take care of that issue before you start getting into, okay, what are you going to do with what's left? And I think once that happens and we get to a situation where we think we've removed everybody who could be a threat to public safety in the United States, then we can really take a look at the situation. But even before we get to that point, you're going to have to put some sort of enforcement, protections in place so you don't have more people coming to the country illegally. Main reason why they come to the U.S. is because they want to get jobs. So we would be heavily in favor of passing the E-Verify requirement so all companies have to use E-Verify to verify the employment eligibility of workers when they hire them, and that we think will help root out most or prevent most people in the country illegally from applying for jobs, which is the main reason why they come.
Okay.
If they find out that they can't get a job when they come to the United States, they'll stop coming. So, you know, I think he's going to focus on interior enforcement. I think there will be deportations, but again, I think he's going to really start with, and this is something that he has said, he's not going to go to the person who's in the country illegally who has done nothing wrong but be here illegally first. He's going to focus on the folks that have been convicted of robbing stores or being affiliated with violent gangs mm-hmm. or committed violent crimes first.
Okay, and finally, the wall. The wall was a big selling point and a big rallying cry for a long time. What do you put the odds on us seeing a ginormous, huge, awesome, built quicker than ever, world record time, wall going across the whole southern border of the U.S.
That's a pretty good impersonation of him.
Yeah, it's terrible, but I guess I got 4 years to master it now.
There you go. The wall is something as an organization, Numbers USA, we don't support the wall. We think there are a whole lot more things that you can do mm-hmm. to prevent future illegal immigration besides building a wall, E-Verify for starters, which I just mentioned, and mandatory or biometric entry exit system, which tracks foreign visitors coming into that country so you know who's overstayed their visa.
Mm-hmm.
That could come first. But Congress did pass back in 2006, both Hillary Clinton and President Obama voted for it when they were in the Senate, the Secure Fence Act of 2006. And what that required was double reinforced fencing along 700 miles of the border. And if you had that in place, that would allow Border Patrol to focus their energy and their attention on the vulnerable areas of the southwest border. Right now, they have to protect the whole thing because you really only have the double reinforced fencing in places like San Diego, Yuma and Douglas, Arizona, El Paso, Texas. A lot of the rest of the border is unprotected. So if you actually implemented the Secure Fence Act, which is law, which again requires that 700 miles of fencing, then the Border Patrol can focus its energy and efforts in other places, in the more vulnerable places. It's going to be hard to build a wall or a fence, for that matter, in some of these mountainous areas of New Mexico, for example. So we do hope he beefs up border security. If he builds a wall, he builds a wall. It's not what we're advocating for. We're just advocating for, again, completion of the Secure Fence Act 2006.
Chris Chmielewski is the Director of Content and Activism for Numbers USA. You can find more at numbersusa.com. Follow them on Twitter at numbersusa. Chris, it's been fascinating. I appreciate the conversation. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about in the near future. Thanks so much for jumping on the phone.
Thanks for having me again.
You're listening to the Matt Bubala Show, 720 WGN.